There have been many significant centenaries in recent months, events that have been recounted and analysed by this show and many others, from the armistice to the 1918 general election, and of course the meeting of the First Dáil in January 1919, and just today, that pivotal Sligo local government election in 1919, which used PR. Well, we're going to look now at a very significant centenary that hasn't got as much attention. It's an episode that heralded a big reduction in the length of the working week, affecting the lives of countless thousands of working people in Ireland and Britain. During World War I, workers in all industries had to accept long hours and low pay. And with the war over, and as the demands on industry eased, many workers were determined to achieve better conditions and a shorter working week. And in January 1919, there was a massive industrial strike in Belfast. It practically brought the city to a total halt as thousands of well-organised engineering workers staged a walkout. The strike lasted for 4 weeks. Shops and factories closed, trams stopped running, bread ran low, and the British Army was ultimately called back in to take control of power stations. To talk about this, I'm joined in studio by historian and author Padraig Yates. Padraig, you're very welcome back to the History Show. What kind of hours were people working in 1919? So, First World War is over, that emergency is over. What kind of hours were they still working at that stage?
Well, during the war, they were working a basic week of 54 hours, and a lot of people would be doing overtime on top of that. So, you're talking about a minimum working week of probably 60 hours. And because wages in the war never caught up with inflation, or did maybe to some extent at the very end, people had to do overtime simply to pay the bills. And that applied in Belfast as much as anywhere else. So in August 1918, the unions, the engineering unions, put in a claim for a 44-hour week. And there was protracted negotiations. And then eventually, towards the end of the year, due to pressure from the government, the employers agreed to concede 47 hours. And there was a ballot. It was a very low ballot. About a third of the workers bothered to vote. It was narrowly accepted across the United Kingdom, but two places rejected it. One was Clydeside and the other was Belfast, which were the two biggest centres of shipbuilding in the United Kingdom at that time. So it was serious. The Clydeside workers, the workers' council there, actually wanted a reduction not of to 44 hours, but to 30 hours. And the thinking behind it was not simply that they were tired working these enormous hours, but there were all these men coming back from the front. Mm. There were nearly a million men demobilised by the end of 1918, and they were still coming back at the rate of 10,000 a day. And you've got to remember that that Britain mobilised nearly 6 million troops from within the United Kingdom. So there's huge numbers coming back. There were about 1.5 million women, over 1.5 million women, doing jobs which had previously been done by men.
So there was plenty of scope for the reduction of hours.
Well, they needed it if they were going to reabsorb these people into the workforce. And was the Red Scare. The Russian Revolution wasn't that old, and it seemed unstoppable. You've got to remember, it wasn't until 1920 that the Red Army stopped advancing either east or south and west. So there was a genuine fear amongst employers and the ruling class. And Lloyd George sold the idea of shorter working hours for the same money on the basis that it was insurance to stop revolution.
Okay, go back to World War One, and you would have thought that unions would have had employers over a barrel during the war because there would have been huge labour shortages. And if you look at agriculture, farmers, Irish farmers in particular, were able to parlay shortages and parlay the war into increasing their own incomes. Why was that not the case with workers?
Well, it was the case with workers, and wages did go up. It took a long while to catch up with prices. But there was a deal done. The British government very consciously took a decision that they couldn't fight the Germans and the trade union movement at the same time, because the whole of the United Kingdom had been disrupted by non-stop industrial strife, really, from about 1910 until the outbreak of war, nearly. So the deal was they would give unions recognition in the workplace. There was de facto union recognition. And in return, the unions would agree not to strike. So when you got to the deadlock situation where the employers wouldn't give any more, the unions wouldn't settle for any less, both sides had to agree to binding arbitration. And that worked more or less up until the end of the war. It was beginning to creak by then. But interestingly enough, during the war, union membership in the United Kingdom doubled from 4 million to 8 million. In Ireland, it trebled because of this system of union recognition. And by the end of the war, what was happening was workers were dissatisfied, they weren't getting more. So who do you blame? Well, you don't actually blame the employers, you blame the union for not coming back with a better deal. By the end of the war, there was a very powerful shop stewards movement in Britain and in Belfast, not in the south, because unions here were very small and your local general secretary lived around the corner. But in Britain, they were very remote from the workforce. So you had this huge shop stewards movement built up. So in places like Clydeside and in Belfast was this huge dissatisfaction. We want a better deal and we couldn't care less what you've negotiated. We're coming out on strike and now the war's over. No one can stop us.
Right. Okay. So just to go back to the fact that all over the UK and in Ireland, 47 hours a week is accepted, except on Clydeside and except in Belfast. And in Belfast, the general election is called, and it's called for December, but there's a mass meeting before the election actually takes place, after it's announced and before it takes place. Tell us about that meeting.
There's a meeting in the Ulster Hall of the engineering workers or their representatives, because we couldn't take them all. But at that meeting, they invited all the candidates to come. It was the day before the election. All of the Labour candidates, bar one, attended. All of the Unionist candidates attended, including Sir Edward Carson.
Who was standing in a Belfast constituency.
None of the Sinn Féin candidates turned up. And Joe Devlin, who was the only nationalist MP for Belfast, sent a note apologising for not being able to attend. But he said he had a slight cold, which was his way of saying, I'm not interested.
Why did none of the Sinn Féin candidates turn up?
Because they knew 90% of these workers were Protestant and loyalist. So they'd be wasting their time going. Or they'd probably be afraid of a lot of hostility as well. But it was indicative. We people tend to sell the National Revolution as being very progressive and egalitarian and that. But it was actually quite conservative and still rooted very much in the past. So they basically wrote these people off. There was another complicating factor in Belfast, which was that quite a lot of shipyard workers had gone to the war. I mean, Workman Clark, the wee yard, as it was called. George Clark, the owner, the managing director, marched 500 or 600 of his employees down to the recruiting office when war broke out, and they all joined up. He didn't. He went back to work. But a huge chunk of his workers went into the British Army, and there was a feeling, which we don't know how real it is, a lot of work needs to be done on that. There was a feeling that Catholics had replaced all these men. So there was that fear as well. When we come back, are all our jobs going to be taken by these Catholics? And what are they going to do? Are they going to insist, well, we're here now and we've got to stay? So there was that tension underlying it on top of the constitutional issue of, are we in the United Kingdom or are we not in the United Kingdom?
So you have 20,000, I mean, it's incredible to think now, 20,000 shipyard workers in Belfast.
No, you had nearly 30,000 in Harland and Wolff. You had another few thousand in Workman Clark.
Right.
And then you had altogether probably about 40,000 engineering workers when you add in the engineering shops. You've got to remember over 80% of all the ships built in Ireland were built in Belfast. Over 40% of all the goods manufactured in Ireland were manufactured in Belfast. It was completely different from the rest of the island.
And in fact, I mean, Belfast at around that time or a few years before that, I think sometime in the 1890s, had superseded Dublin as the most populous city in Ireland. So it was actually bigger than Dublin at that stage. So the strike begins then on the 25th of January. And is it one issue? Is it, we want a 44-hour week, that's it?
Yeah, it's very much a one-issue strike. They had a ballot actually on the 14th. And that's where they all marched into the city. They lined up on Queen Street in, where the shipyards are, marched across the Albert Bridge, through North Belfast, accumulating more members as they went. So 40,000 workers ended up outside City Hall, and they had a rally there, very disciplined, no disorder whatsoever. And in fact, the chairman, J.J. Hill, at the end of the meeting said, "I want every man to be in work at 6 o'clock in the morning." So, you know, it was very disciplined. They all went off and balloted then, overwhelming ballot strike action, and they all were in work again at 6 o'clock in the morning. But again, on the Saturday, 25th, they all came out as they said they would. And not only did they come out, but the engineering workers in the power plant and in the sewage and waterworks came out as well. So the city suddenly ground to...
So it was effectively a general strike.
It was a general strike. Right. And 20,000 other workers in the mill, in the linen mills, men, most of them women, couldn't go to work because there was no power. And eventually on the Sunday, they realised they had to get power to places like hospitals. So they agreed to limited power being supplied, but no company could tap into that for commercial purposes. And the only violence that occurred was the next day when the Belfast Telegraph and a few city centre businesses tried to access the electricity. And when the lights came on, they were stoned and had to close again. But apart from that, the strike committee ran the city. They even had, the government even agreed to the appointment of special constables, who were all strikers, who would patrol the city and make sure nobody used power illegally, and that law and order was kept.
Okay, two questions occur arising out of what you've just said. The first is that on Clydeside, their troops were sent in. They attacked the strikers. There was violence. Mm. That did not happen in Belfast.
No, it didn't, because, again, getting into Irish politics, Hackett Payne was the commander of the British garrison in Belfast, the British Army commander. He had been a senior commander in the UVF before the war, joined the army, became a general officer, came back, and he worked hand in glove with Dawson Bates, who later became notorious as the enforcer for the Stormont government when it was set up. But at that stage, they were both in regular contact with Carson and Craig in London, the unionist leaders there, who were in touch then directly with Lloyd George and with Bonner Law, who was obviously very sympathetic towards them. And they said, look, you keep the troops out of Belfast. These men are not a threat to the system in any way, so long as they're treated with respect.
Did they police the whole thing themselves?
They policed they actually had more control over Belfast than the Limerick Soviet had in Limerick.
That was my second question.
Yes.
Question was this a Soviet? Because the Limerick Soviet is famous, but there were actually dozens of Soviets or Soviets around the country during this period. Was this, in essence, a Soviet?
Well, it depends what you mean by a Soviet. I mean,
Soviet,
is, as far as I know, I'm not an expert, but it's only a Russian word meaning council. So if you had a workers' and peasants' council, it was like a local authority in Russia.
Well, I think in Limerick they did call it a Soviet.
They did, yeah. In imitation of Russia. Mm. But it wasn't actually running the city. It was running the strike, and it was providing food and helping people with transport and all the rest. But it was, I mean, famously, as one American journalist said, you know, they stopped for the say the novena, you know, at 6 o'clock in the evening, and the when the I can't remember her name asked the question of the bishop, you know, what do you make of these communists who are, you know, saying decades of the rosary on picket duty? And he said, well, they're Catholic communists, so they're okay. So, well, these were Protestant communists, if you like, who probably were not okay with the bishop, but the politically, this was never a challenge to the state. And the unionists had the sense to realise, if we send the troops in here the way they were sent in Glasgow and there is blood spilt, we could lose control of us.
So this wasn't Red Clyde. This was not Red Belfast.
But they held out longer than Red Clydeside, which settled about 2 weeks nearly before they
did. Did they get any support from Dublin?
They were offered support from Dublin. They were offered support. In fact, Dublin did benefit to this extent that the council in Dublin, the councillors who were mainly Sinn Féin and Labour councillors, actually voted to give their own staff, the manual staff, the 47-hour week in case the strike spread south. And the ITUC, the Irish Trade Union Congress, offered to bring out other workers in support of Belfast. But interestingly enough, the Belfast workers wouldn't let the women out, and they wouldn't form alliances.
When you said they wouldn't let the women out, they didn't want them to go on strike.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, it was the Edwardian or Victorian notion of manhood. You know, we'll fight this battle, and when we win, you'll all be looked after, and we'll make sure you're looked after too. But it's women shouldn't really be on the picket line in the way that men are. So it was very much asserting their masculinity, if you like. But also there's a very common sense argument that they would have to be laid off if there was no power, and they could go and get unemployment benefit. If they came out on strike, they wouldn't be eligible for it at all. So why go on strike? So it was a combination of things, but in a way more significant.
Good Ulster pragmatism.
Well, of a sort. Yes and no, because they wouldn't allow the railway workers offered to come out. But because some of them were in the transport union, they were seen as suspect, they were influenced by, they were secret Sinn Féin, so we don't be tainted by that. So it was this classic, if you like, Ulster or Belfast Protestant working class. You can't put them in a, you know, you can't, they're square pegs in round holes. You cannot pigeonhole them the way, they don't suit the nationalists because they're a complete aberration, don't treat the socialists for the same reason, and the unionists prefer to forget about it.
How did it end?
It ended with them going back, a very orderly return to work after 4 weeks. Lord Pirrie, the shipping controller for the United Kingdom and the biggest shipping owner in the world at that time, said he would call all the other employers together and see if he could get them all to accept the 44-hour week, that he was willing to give it, but only if all the other shipyards did. He couldn't get them together. It ended in October 1920 with a few minor concessions, but by then you had the pogroms. And funny enough, the man who led the strike was Charlie Mackay, a member of the Carpenters Union, who was actually a Catholic, and he was expelled, along with a lot of the other strike committee, as unreliable in July 1920, when the pogroms began.
Okay, the pogroms, an entirely different story. Yes. We don't have time to go into to them at the moment, but we will, I think, hopefully we will come back to those before the end of the current run. And Pádraig Yates, thank you very much for joining us this evening to talk about that pivotal Belfast engineering strike of 1919. That's all we've got time for this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as our podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/history. Thanks tonight to Cara O'Hare on sound and our researcher, Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.